7 meta tips on how to tell what is true. These are 7 big picture items to keep in mind as you are going through your other tips on what to do. So the other list was what to do, and this list is big picture things to keep in mind. 7 meta tips on how to tell what is true, how to sort out what is true and good from that which is false and bad. Welcome back, everybody. This is Overcoming Learning Problems, sponsored by The Great Shalom. I'm Sharon Searles. Today we're going to talk about 7 meta principles to keep in mind when you are trying to sort out what's true as opposed to false, which of course is correlated with what is good and what is evil. And this really is an issue, of course, for everybody, but especially for those students who are, quote unquote, learning disabled. I hate that term, but just so you know what I'm talking about. Children who are having some difficulty in school, even when they're bright, tend to often have a bully target on them. Often they tend to be naive. This is true for many bright students, and even for the less bright, they can be snookered. But for the learning disabled, perhaps it is because they are spending so much effort to try to keep up with school, and they're spending so much effort to keep up with decoding language that they may miss some of the more subtle cues. Of course, it is possible for those people who just don't do well in school. Maybe they have other talents and they're pretty good about street smarts. But many of our students who have LD diagnosis in school, we find they just don't. And so let's teach this directly. And particularly for students who are spending an inordinate amount of time just keeping up with the schoolwork, especially when school is not teaching them this, then we may need to teach it directly. So here are 7, I'll call it principles or meta tips, 7 things to keep in mind to sort out, help you sort out what's true and what's false, and I'll give them right to you. Bias, liars, skeptic, questions, research, foundations, and faith. Okay, that's what I'm going to talk about, and it'll make sense later. Bias, liars, skepticism, questions, research, foundation, and faith. First off, let's talk about bias. We all have it. It's part of the human condition because we are limited, finite beings encased in matter. We just are not going to have an omnipresent, omnicompetent view on things. It's just not possible. We all have bias. We all come from someplace on the elephant, and so we're going to have a perspective, and therefore confirmation bias will always play a role. We will tend to believe certain things because they match with what we already know, but there are some things we don't know. And we may be mistaken, and we don't want to overlook truth that we need. In fact, I remember a graduate course I enjoyed very much. This is my recollection anyway. This was a survey introductory theology course taught by Clark Pinnock in the summer at Regent. And I think he said something along the lines of, well, let me just tell you what my biases are up front. And so somebody who is that masterful and is teaching a survey course to say that, I think, was unusual. Anyway, I never heard of such a thing. But I realized immediately that it was true. A professor is going to be a human being. A professor is going to take a position. And for a professor to say up front, this is my bias, I thought that was highly refreshing. And here's a college tip. You should figure out what the bias of your professor is right off so you don't tick them off. But if you can tick off a professor who is a master of that kind of conversation, know that you yourself have hot button issues. You have your own bias, and you can distract yourself and deceive yourself because of your own biases, because you let your own emotions hijack you. I just listened to the episode on tips for sorting out what's true. I just kind of made an informal whack at it back in February of 2021. And I realized, of course, I didn't tell you the whole story and things. And because I did it sort of off the cuff, I'm sure there were many opportunities for people just to be ticked off because of their bias. Like, I didn't tell you the full story about me being in the file room and why my friend's ethnic background mattered. And this was, you know, 1971, and what was going on there. And it all fits together, but I'm not going to take time right now to, but that's just one example. Lots of other examples of, it's just easy to have our own emotions hijack us and make us stupid, make us not listen, make us close our ears, make us not respond as rationally as possible. We all have a bias. The person you're talking to has a bias, and you have a bias, and all those biases are rooted in fear and pride, because that's part of the human condition. So you need to make allowance for that. You need to learn how to be more mature, how to put down that kind of noise, so that you can listen very closely to what they're saying, and so that you can put what you want to say in as winsome as possible. All right, then you need to leave some allowances that there are liars in the world. There are liars in the world, and there are many people who are mistaken because they have been lied to. Many people are mistaken. Have you studied how to tell what is true before? Well, what about the people down the block from you? What about your relatives who you think are not quite as smart as you? And then think about all the families who are not as smart as your family, right? Do you get my point here? Lots of people are mistaken, but the problem is that somewhere in the world, there are liars, and these liars intend to deceive other people. And they, unfortunately, intend to deceive you, rob you. And you know this in business. You know that there are some people who lie. You know this on the street. Now, not everybody knows that on the street. You know, a lot of immigrants, they come from some country. Let's just make up a story. So they're brand new here from Honduras, and so they speak Spanish, only Spanish, and they have just arrived in, let's just make it Texas, and they're walking down Congress Avenue, that's our major street downtown, and there are some people who come up to them and act like they're befriending them, in Spanish, of course, and end up robbing them, because a Honduran doesn't happen to sort out as quickly as they might the situation that exists in downtown Austin. But there are a lot of people in downtown Austin who know that their immigrants are showing up. So, example. We know this, but when we're new to a situation, we are more vulnerable. And unfortunately, because we have tried to shield our children to some extent, and of course, some extent that's good and right and proper, and we've tried to give them idealistic views and hope that they will be true and honest and giving and so forth, then if they don't know that there are liars and evil workers in the world, they'll be more susceptible to them. Sophia Lyon Foss was a religious educator. She was a liberal Presbyterian, and then she served the Unitarian Church. Back in the 50s, she wrote Sunday school curriculum for these denominations. It was highly liberal and was very idealistic. And her children grew up and said that they felt that their mother was well thought of, well loved, and virtuous and wonderful and well respected. And in many ways, they thought that their rearing was deficient in this point, that they had not been exposed to evil. And this was necessary. It's necessary to know that there are liars in the world. There are evil people in the world. Fortunately, not everybody is evil. Most people are merely mistaken. But it's important to know. And it's important to know that the most competent, the most skilled evil people can sound good. You know, Satan masquerades as an angel of light. Recently, the guidestones in Georgia were knocked down. And if you read what was on there, most of that sounds pretty good. Today, having population control sounds evil because we imagine that that might mean killing people. But years ago, we never imagined that. You know, population control, sure, we should not have more kids than we can manage. Okay, yeah, fine. That even sounded good. But if you read it, you mean you're going to kill the majority of people on the planet? And then you start reading the other things and you suspect that this might be nefarious, then it sounds a whole lot different then. So, of course, everybody reads and hears everything based on their own bias. All right. So all I'm saying is you need to keep in your mind that it is there is a possibility that you're hearing from a liar. Now, so therefore, we're skeptical because we know, for instance, in business and in advertising that people do lie. We tend to be somewhat skeptical about marketing and advertising and sales claims. I certainly was taught this directly. I would sit watching the television with advertisements on when I was a young person in the 60s, and my mother would sit with me and break apart these claims and help me read advertising. And I feel like I am somewhat less susceptible to advertising claims in general than most people because my mother did this and did this regularly. So I think that millennials and younger people have an inbuilt skepticism about most claims. However, I think that the skepticism, while necessary, have a certain amount of skepticism that you check out what you're being told, you because you know that it's possible that you have faced a liar or somebody who's mistaken, somebody who's trying to snooker you, or somebody just doesn't know what they're talking about. It's necessary to have skepticism, but it's also possible to drown in skepticism. If you're skeptical about everything to the point that you don't listen, you don't check out, then you're going to miss a lot of useful things. I don't know. I was trying to think of an example that's non-controversial, and probably there is no such thing as a non-controversial statement. But imagine, here it goes. Imagine DOS, who's the computer program on the basis of which individual computers were built. DOS was constructed, and IBM passed on it, and they said, Nobody's going to want an individual computer. And Bill Gates evaluated that differently and bought DOS. I don't have to say much more, right? They were skeptical about the uses of it. They say, you know, people, some households have typewriters, right? But who wants an individual computer? That's just not useful. Bill Gates said, a personal computer. That's what a PC is. A personal computer will replace every typewriter and every adding machine on every desk. It turns out he was right on that. So you can be too skeptical and overlook things because of your bias, right? So don't drown in skepticism so that you overlook the wonder and beauty of creation and the great gifts, and somebody might be going out of their way to tell you something truthful that will help you. I can't tell you the times that people have not listened. Now, there is also the case of somebody trying to be helpful but doesn't know your constraints. But I really feel like a lot of times I have gone out of my way to offer information to people because, after all, that's who I am. I study, that's my life, and I teach, that's my life. And I am good-hearted and giving and altruistic to a fault, witness this broadcast. And so, but people so often don't listen. Okay. And so the next one, so we have had bias, liars, skepticism, and the next one is questions, questions, questions. We need to ask a lot more questions. In fact, the next episode on this topic, I'm going to talk about how to listen better and how to ask better questions and how to listen to the answers that you get. But ask questions. Ask questions. Now, we already talked about the Napoleon Hill. Number one question is, how do you know? So you need to find evidence for claims. Because there are people who make claims that there is no evidence for. Goebbels, you know, Goebbels was the master propagandist for Hitler, if I understand or remember correctly. Goebbels knew that if you told a lie often enough, loud enough, people would believe it. And that happens today. We have propagandists, not just in marketing, but other places, propagandists who tell lies that sound convincing, but there is no evidence for. All the evidence is on the contrary. And to my great shock, after a year or two of this and people dying in surprisingly large quantities, I still get people who should be above average of intelligence asserting these things. And I say, there is no evidence for that. There is no evidence for that. Let's look at the evidence. And I've just spent 30 minutes giving them evidence, and they come back with this claim and say, no, there is no evidence for that. All of the evidence is on the other side. So you need to ask questions. The first one is, how do you know? The second one is, ask yourself, am I listening well? How might this help me or harm me? Ask questions. What is going on here? Ask a bunch of questions. We tend not to ask nearly enough questions. And then we need to listen to the answers. Listen to the answers and evaluate those answers, because so often we're snookered because we are getting a response or because we are getting a no response. Many marketers know that just making a repeated claim that seems intriguing, that's what people buy on, you know. So they're trying to sell you a car and they drape a beautiful woman across the hood, but they're not going to tell you the kind of mileage or the crash rating or, you know, how much it costs to maintain or blah, blah, blah. Okay, and you can ask them and they're going to show you more pictures of this car being driven around in swanky settings with beautiful women. See, now, this, because that was done in the 60s a lot and was in propaganda courses. Is that what we called it? Anyway, it was in English class. So that's easy to detect, but there's so many more. All right, ask questions. The next one is, do your own research. So questions are first. If you have a question, then you can research the question. But know the power and the limitations of your research method. Do your own research. Do your own research. Do your own research. Do you know, if you go out and ask people on the street, how many people died from COVID? I'm talking about the United States now. I don't know about in your nation. But if you ask the average person in the street in the United States how many people died from COVID, what percentage of the somebody actually did the survey and came up with people were guessing 10 to 20% of the population, which of course is entirely laughable. Now we're talking about just from COVID, just at the end of 2020, right? So the true answer was less than 1/1,000th. Less than 1/1,000th of the population. How did I come up with that? I did simple math. You take the number of the population divided, you take the number of deaths divided by the population, and then you'll get a numerical answer. So I was talking to a friend in another developed nation, developed enough to have a website and have a health ministry that put out statistics. And she was asking me, why is Texas so much better than my province? So much better. And I said, well, I don't know that it is. Oh, well, it must be. It must be. Why? Well, because you're open and we're not. I said, do you understand there's a logical fallacy in there? Let's just find out what the death rate is in both this state and that province. Let's just do the math. Oh, okay. How do you do that? Well, go on to the provincial website and tell me how many deaths from COVID it is reporting. So this is, late 2020. Okay, so she could do that. I said, all right, so how many people in the province? Well, that was not on that website, but we were able to find it. All right, so now let's do the math. The number of deaths divided by the number of the population equals, we have to go get a calculator. Okay, and what does that come out with? So in Texas at that time, or when I calculated it, which was probably spring of 2020, it was less than 1/1,000th. Okay, so 0.0007. So I know it's sometimes hard to do that by hearing for some people who don't love math. So 0, that means no ones. Then another 0, that means no tenths. Then another 0, that means no 1/100ths. And then, in this case, if there was a 1, it would be 1/1,000th. But the answer came up with a third 0 and then a 7. So that's less than 1/1,000th. Less than one person in 1,000. 0.0007. That's what I calculated the death rate, the reported death rate in Texas with COVID. So that would have been late April. And so my friend and I, we calculated for her province, and we got 0.0005. All right, so that's again less than 1/1,000th. It's 1/2 of 1/1,000th, right? So which is less? 0.0007 or 0.0005, same number of zeros, which is less? The other province. Yeah. Province that's, by the way, been in the news. Province that now this is being recorded in late July of 2022 is being sued by a doctor. And the appellate court has overruled the Court of Queen's Bench and chastised, in strong language, the provincial health service. Anyway, so was her province better or worse? Okay, so we were calculating the death rate from COVID. So I think this was maybe summer, maybe August 2020. The province death rate from COVID was less than 1/1,000th, was 1/2 of 1/1,000th. And state was 7/10 of 1/1,000th. Okay, so which was better? Yeah, the province was. And yet they were still locked down for a long time. Texas was locked down for 2 months. So you understand the math. Do your own math. And then there was the logic. She assumed that Texas was much better because we were open. Well, that's a logical fallacy. I said, okay, now, which is less, 5 or 7? Well, 5 is less than 7. All right, so do you see that based on your calculations, your province has fewer deaths, yes, a lower death rate from COVID reported than my state? Oh, well, that can't be right. Do your own research and do your own math and know the power and the limitation of your research methods. In this case, numbers matter a whole lot more than the squawk you're getting out of the squawk box. Yes, because she made an assumption, a deduction based on, well, it was a fact that Texas was open and her province was not. And she made deductions based on what she was being told through the media. But do your own research. So is there a way to find out what the stats are without going to the news? Well, yes, in that story you found out. You could go to the published numbers, published by the government. All right. And I had somebody who had actually degree in, well, we won't say exactly what, but degrees in related. Well, they could go to the CDC all day long and did, I think, daily in the beginning of the crisis. Okay, so are there limitations to that data? Oh, yeah. Well, we all know, and it's not arguable, that the early death rate was inflated because death with COVID was death with a positive test was classed as death from COVID because hospitals were incented to code it that way. And we all know it's not controversial. We all know that the death rate now is suppressed because all that's counted in the VAERS at best are people who die immediately from the quote unquote vax and not from other causes. You know, for instance, so if they die a month later from a surprising stroke, that's not. And we also know because nurses have told us they were told not to report to VAERS. So we do have an official number of people who have died from the vax, and it's higher, by the way, than all the other vaccines put together. But at least I'm following Dr. Wakefield on that. But I'm sure you can check that out. You can check to see if that's true. Anyway, we do have a published number of deaths from the quote-unquote vax. There are some limitations to that. Okay, and similarly with all research methods. So you can go out on the internet and do a general search, and you can find an amazing amount of information. What you may not realize is there information that you can't find. So I remember back in the 90s, we went out and we Google searched the Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama was going to come to my metro area. And so we were looking up Dalai Lama, what he had recently said, and so forth, and we couldn't find anything. There's nothing on the internet about the Dalai Lama. Maybe one article, maybe two articles. That was it. What? What? Nothing in Google about the Dalai Lama. Right, because Google was the biggest internet provider at that point in China and communist China, red China, which I'm not supposed to say anymore. I've been informed. It's not politically correct. But China, led by the Communist Party, had either made an agreement or at least put pressure on Google not to show search query answers about the Dalai Lama, because the Dalai Lama was not in favor with the CCP. The Dalai Lama wasn't even living in Tibet, but in northern India, because the CCP had overrun Tibet, which they claim was always their territory. Right. Anyway, so at that point, the best internet search left out a big hole. And continue to see this. You understand that any internet search you get, you're going to first find the ads, and then you're going to find the most hit articles. And very few people go down beyond the fold, let alone three pages down. And so you're not getting an unbiased query ever. There are some search engines that track you less, and there may be some search engines that don't take advertising, but there are none that are going to be completely nirvana. Okay, so know the power and the limitations. Okay, so I have said, and this is kind of a quick and dirty for freshman students, that what stands as science is peer-reviewed journals. But you need to know the power and the limitation of that. So, wow, you can get PubMed. You can go to PubMed and do a search of medical peer-reviewed journals. Amazing. But there are so much limitations to that. One is the search terms themselves. I did a search recently. So can a vaccinated person, quote unquote, a vaxxed person, infect other people with COVID? That was what I was trying to find. Well, you know, there's just nothing about that in PubMed. But if you look up spike proteins, you're going to find plenty of hits. You understand what I'm saying? The search term, you have to understand the correct search term. Then you're going to have to be able to read those articles. And by the way, this is really true. You cannot depend on titles. Now, in peer-reviewed journals, you should be able to pin the abstract. But in newspaper articles and so forth, what you read in the... Oh, and Wikipedia in particular. Do not depend on the citation. Read the article, because often the article says opposite to the headline or the citation. That's particularly true in Wikipedia. But even once you get into what appears to be a really scientific article, if you read it carefully, you will see quite a lot of things. One is, how large is the N? How large is the number of respondents? So in a medical journal, you can publish something with an N of 6. A sociology journal, an N of less than 1,000 would be considered silly. And you have to know these things. Did they do an adequate literature review? Did they cover all of literature or just some? Is their model for research, does it adequately get everything? Do they find enough statistical support for what they're saying? And this is a whole, you know, a whole semester course. And of course, unfortunately, it is true that there is some political bias about what gets published and what does not. Sociology professors have gotten together, written papers, and stripped names off. It's supposed to be you strip the name of the author and the institution off and send it in. But they did an experiment and put prestigious names and prestigious university names and the same paper without those, and found that the ones with the prestigious names were much more likely to be published. So, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, sorry, there is bias there. But science is supposed to be able to write itself, that it's supposed to stay open. And, you know, when Einstein came up with the theory of relativity, he was laughed off the block. So, what science today is not, by definition, is not the final answer. And sometimes science is a bit slow to catch up because of its political and financial bias. All right, so know the power and the limitations of your research tools. Finally, have a good foundation. It helps a whole lot if you just know something. You know what you know and you know what you don't know. If you know something, for instance, because I took methodology courses in sociology, then it's easier for me to sort out what's nonsense and what's not nonsense when I read a sociological paper or something that's purporting to be somewhat sociological on the internet. And boy, this has been true. I've seen this with my students. Freshman students are not expected to know anything about sociology except what the textbook tells them or I lecture them. They're supposed to know that, but sometimes they don't read the textbook and don't listen in class. But anyway, and then they have an assignment and they go out on the internet and they find some claim, some quote-unquote information. And it's very hard for them to sort out what's true. So I tell them, if you go to Britannica, the Encyclopedia Britannica, the method at Britannica is to get a scholar from that field to write the article, and then they'll give you more citations. And so that information is probably as good as you can get as a student. Do they listen to me? No, because it would take effort to go to the library. So they go to Wikipedia. The founder of Wikipedia says Wikipedia is not good enough for college papers. Or worse, they just go and do a general search and they come back and say stuff. Did you hear what I said in class? This is nonsense. Anyway, and then they look at me and they just don't know what. So it really helps if you have some kind of foundation. Know what you do know. Know what you do know. And know what you don't know. And it's good from there. Okay, I'm going to tell you this story. I have not told you this story. I'm the butt of the story, but all right. But I forgot my own foundations. So at one point in the 90s, I visited a very conservative megachurch, and it happened to be the 4th of July, and they were talking about the founders of the United States, meaning the people who signed the Constitution. And we're talking about them as all godly men and everything. And I walked out of there shaking my head, said, in this big room, nobody realized that those founders were deists. I walked out to my car. I was noticing people's bumper stickers. Perhaps I had one on my car. Anyway, I was looking at their bumper sticker. They were looking at mine. I was looking at them. They were like, I began to be frightened that I might be hurt. So I rushed, got in my car, and went home. A few years later, I was listening to David Barton, and he was going over the men who signed the Constitution. He was in Statuary Hall and showing pictures and saying where they had gotten their post-secondary training. And John Witherspoon was a Presbyterian minister, and on and on and on. Most of these men had divinity training in the Reformed tradition. Most of these men had divinity training in the Reformed tradition. And I began to remember that, yeah, I had known that. I had a master's degree in the Reformed tradition, and I knew that John Witherspoon was a Presbyterian. And I apparently had forgotten that, and on and on and on. So it came down to just a few men who maybe were deists. And I just had to smack my head. Like, I had forgotten. I had forgotten the history that I knew because I had been taught claims. And since then, I've learned that some of the things I was taught in history, some of the things I thought I knew, particularly that I didn't learn in the history class, but from books that purported to be history, I had been lied to. Specifically, I had found a book that said that George Washington wasn't an honorable man, that he had been going around sleeping with all the women, and of course that's just baloney, but I thought I wasn't taught that in history simply because it wasn't sweet, but no, actually, it's just a lie. Not even talking about the lie that I was taught in class that all these men were deists, and they weren't, and I knew they weren't. Why did I? Oh, well, that's the way it goes. But I have known some historians that were similarly confused. Know your foundations and remember your foundations, what you really do know. And finally, faith. So we've had bias, liars, skepticism, questions, research, foundations, and faith. I would urge upon you the stance that there is truth. There is some truth. We know that there is such a thing as truth because we have a word for it. There is true as opposed to evil. So at least theoretically, there is truth. And if there is truth, even theoretically, then we can say this is more true than the other. This is more good or appropriate way to proceed than the other. We all know that's true. We all know that's true. And so there is such a thing as truth, because in our world today and for 100 years, there has been an attempt to help us unbelieve, help us to be skeptical of anything that we think is true. And they appear to want to live in skepticism that nothing may be true. But what we have seen in the past, few years, is that they have done that so well, and now they want to substitute a fake truth. For many years, they urged upon us a skepticism. They tore down everything that was true and everything that was good and everything that was beautiful. And now they want to substitute. They want to give us their truth and not let us speak against it, not let us ask questions against it, not let us have questions, not let us have a voice, not let us have any alternate view, not let us have questions. Not let us have research, not let us have foundations. They are substituting the false, the evil, and the ugly for the true, the good, and the beautiful. This, so far up to now, has been logic, but I would urge upon you more than that, that there is truth with a capital T. God is truth. And we can apprehend it at least glancingly, because we can have this discussion. We believe in Christianity that God, who is all truth and all love and all justice, has reached down to us in the person of Jesus. I would urge upon you, if you do not know that this is true, that you research this, ask questions about it, investigate this. But if you do know this, if this is your foundation, I urge that you would remember it, that you would rehearse it, that you would teach it to your children, that you would grab a hold of it and hold it tight, because in this hour, we need it. And so those are my 7 meta principles, my big picture meta tips on how to tell what is true and what is false. Bias, liars, skepticism, questions, research, foundations, and faith. Know it, use it, teach it to your children.
Thank you for joining us for the Great Shalom Broadcast with your host, Sharon Sarles. Sharon is an author, educator, minister, parent, and grandparent committed to sharing the understanding of God's love and desire that all children experience optimal well-being in this generation and the generations to come.